Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Wherever you are, this is the Interpreter's Workshop Podcast. I'm Tim Curry, your host. Here we talk everything sign language interpreting. The ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the sideways of interpreting. If you're a student, a new interpreter, experienced interpreter, this is the place for you. If you want to know more, go to interpretersworkshop.com. Let's start talking interpreting. And now, the quote of the day by renowned Swedish actress Ingrid Bergman. The key to happiness is good health and a bad memory. In today's episode, we join Joni again as she delves deeper into the details of working conditions for interpreters in the United States, specifically in the states of Texas and Oklahoma. We look at some of the influences that pushed for more interpreters, but also had some negative connotations. We look at how interpreters should be proud of their work and how ethics plays a part in our development through the years. So before I forget, that joke will make more sense when you get to the end of the episode. So before I forget, thank you all for sharing this episode, this podcast, and for supporting me. Let's get started. When you become certified, no matter what state you're living in, how do you find jobs? How do you get paid? All of that.
Here now we have, If we go back to vocational rehab, in the beginning, the organizations like TSHA, which is Tulsa Speech and Hearing
Association,
I guess, or advocacy. I can't remember exactly what it was anyway. They later changed it to TSHA, just the acronym. But anyway, that organization, the referral agency here in Oklahoma City, SLRS, Sign Language Resource Services, they had the agreement with vocational rehab to manage finding interpreters for different things that VR needed. VR allotted them a certain amount of money, and they paid the interpreters through that. Well, when the ADA became stronger and was actually the effects of it was being felt more, then those agencies worked to advocate for deaf people and interpreters by sharing the information with different providers or with different entities that needed to pay for interpreting services. They would advocate for that and drop contracts. You know, like TSHA might make a contract with a hospital in town. And so anytime the hospital knew that they needed an interpreter, they would go through TSHA. So these referral agencies made the connections between interpreters and those who needed the interpretation services. Mm-hmm. And so when someone went through a program, graduated, did their testing, got some credentials behind their name, then they sign up with the referral agency. That's the easiest way for them to then be contacted for jobs. Mm-hmm. The referral agencies would look at this list that they had and match the interpreter with the situation. Mm-hmm. And ideally what they will do and still do is find the highest qualified person for that job. Mm-hmm. Or the one who fits that job the best as far as they can figure that out. And it's a really convenient way to work as an interpreter if you go through the interpreting agency, because they take care of all the billing and they take care of the payment. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of interpreters who also like doing it on their own rather than contracting with an agency, so that they can have control of how much they charge and how much work they do and so forth. Sometimes they'll do it on their own. It's more difficult because you have to be an advocate for yourself. You've got to advertise your availability and all that. And then you've got to do the billing and expect to get paid and all that. But some people prefer to do it that way rather than contract with an agency. That's how people typically get paid.
Well, that's the way I remember it too. When after I left, or yeah. I remember the days when we were using, you know, the actual paper map to figure out where we're going.
Amazing how we were able to get around.
I know. It's just strange how you even know where you're driving instead of relying on the smartphone to talk to you.
That's right. And had to find a payphone if we needed to make a call. How did we survive?
I know. My daughter, when she was 3 or 4, she knew the vocabulary word destination because of the smartphone saying, she says, Daddy, she said we're at our destination.
When you're only 3, you're not supposed to know that word.
Things have changed.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing because at OSU OKC, my department, I was in charge of the interpreting program, but also in charge of deaf student services. And so when we hired interpreters, we had to keep detailed records as to how much they were paid and all that, because then we submitted that to vocational rehab every month. And that showed that we were spending the money that they had allocated to us in the way that they had purposed that we do that. So when they finally decided, we don't need to be giving y'all money anymore, they, over a 4-year period of time, decreased it, you know, 25% each year until they weren't paying anymore. Mm-hmm. And the school had to take that over, which is a gracious way for them to do that, because the school had that 4 years to mm-hmm. prepare their budgets to absorb that cost. They did it in a nice way.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've worked in Texas and Oklahoma most of your interpreting career, I guess.
Right.
Were there big differences between the states?
Well, hard to say when.
And I don't mean sports or politics.
Yeah. Right. And people
are
great in both states.
Oh, yes.
When we left Texas, that was in 82. Mm-hmm. And so the switch here, I think they pretty much were the same. It was still vocational rehab, Department mm-hmm. of Human Services that did the most as far as hiring interpreters or paying for interpreters, or educational, you know, schools mm-hmm. also that paid for interpreters. Which that's another thing that we should mention. As far as history is concerned, all of a sudden I can't remember what that's, public law 94-142. I can't remember now what the name mm-hmm. of that law is, but it's the one that went through that said that students should be able to attend a school close to their home.
Yeah.
Which for some of us, we look at that as the destruction of the schools for the deaf, you know, because all of a sudden parents could say, I don't want to send my child to this school for the deaf. I want them to go to school here, close to home. Mm-hmm. That started the educational interpreting movement, you know,
yeah.
to where schools had to hire interpreters or teachers to work with their deaf students that wanted to come to the school. So that was in that, you know, they were major employers of interpreters from the beginning too, from back then. Mm. And now I can't remember what your other question was, and I went back to that.
Uh-huh. Was there differences between Texas and Oklahoma?
Oh, between the states? I don't think so. Not too much. You know, both of our states, and I'm sure lots of other states as well, Texas was actually the first to come up with some type of evaluation system for interpreters. Mm-hmm. And the TSID, Texas Society of Interpreters for the Deaf, came up with a 3-level evaluation system for interpreters back then. Oklahoma was doing a similar thing later, but they did a similar thing in having just a very basic mm-hmm. like, for example, in Texas, the very first evaluation that I took was the basic interpreting skills certificate. And it was, do your alphabet, now spell some words, now sign some sentences, and now try to read what these people are saying when they're signing.
Wow.
You know, I mean, just real basic, just to get your foot in the door. And then they had, two more levels up for that. So they were both trying to do that, to credential their interpreters sort of as a stepping stone to then be ready to take the RID test.
I see.
Because they wanted to get people working, because they could see that the need was getting greater and greater for more interpreters. But I think they were doing about the same thing. Oklahoma, when we moved here, they were actually doing better at pay than Texas was. The hourly rates for interpreters who were nationally certified, their rates were higher than what Texas was paying. But I think now they're more comparable. I think they've kind of moved up and increased that together.
Mm-hmm. So when you say Texas was the first to create an evaluation for interpreters, is that before RID's national, or?
That's a good question. I would venture to say that it was before, but it may not have been, because initially RID was set up to have, it's the Registry of Interpreters. Mm-hmm. It was basically to have a listing of interpreters so that when people needed someone, they could contact them.
Right.
And then their testing came later. But I couldn't say for sure which one was first. I do know that TSID was set up, I believe, before RID was.
Right.
As an organization. But I'm not sure about the testing part.
Okay.
That's why they don't have RID in their name. You know, most state organizations are like OKRID, ARID, but Texas is still TSID.
Yeah, because it was in the state first before it was a national organization outside.
Right.
I see. Yeah.
They're kind of braggy about that, you know?
Yeah, I would say they were a little braggy. Yeah.
Texans, every now and then.
They think they're the first. Yeah.
That's right.
A big thank you to everyone who shares this podcast with a colleague and friend. If you want to support the show even more, check out the show notes for links to buy me a coffee, because it's very embarrassing to fall asleep during an interview. Thank you. Let's go back. Back to the college.
Yeah.
Or the university. When the students graduated, in order to work, they needed to have a certification, or did you do the certification testing at the school, or how were they evaluated?
Well, we did a mock evaluation, we called it, to give them the experience of what it's like to test, you know, your skills. So they had that experience before they graduated. Mm-hmm. But then they had to take up that initiative on their own once they graduated to go and sign up and take the test with the state. Now, Oklahoma has a 5-tiered system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Had to think that through. It's been a while. I'm retired, you know, so.
Well, yes.
But anyway, they have a testing system. It's called a screening test. It's not technically a certification, although that's the word we use for it all the time, that you're certified.
Yeah.
But in Oklahoma, there's a listing of what kinds of things you can do at certain levels, the limitations of the levels. So if you have a level one, you're really not in a place to do much interpreting at all. It's just saying you've got some skills and you need to work on that. And you should have a level three before you start doing any educational interpreting. And that's actually been put into a law.
A level three.
Uh-huh.
State law.
Right. That requires that. And then, and of course, there was some pushback on that from schools because they didn't want to have to pay their interpreters at that level.
Mm-hmm.
You know how that is. We're always fighting for that, places that don't want to pay. And I get that they want things for free like I do. But if you want quality and you want education to go well, you need to have some skill sitting there in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have at least a level four to do more intense kinds of things, a level five to do medical interpreting. And then you need to have a, you know, a national certification to do legal interpreting and things like that. So you've got those kinds of requirements. And usually I would say that the majority of people that came out of the program would test at a level two at least.
Yeah.
And then they would know, they have a sense of what, you know, they just need to get more experience, got to have more time in the field before you can move up in those levels. And
yeah,
that's always been the hardest thing, is you've got to have more experience to be able to move up in your level of certification. But then you've got to have a good level to be able to get some experience. So
yeah,
it's always, always a conundrum there. What are you going to do trying to figure out? I think you just got to be willing to immerse yourself in the deaf community and be around it as much as possible to be able to build those skills.
Mm-hmm. It builds not only the language fluency, but your confidence in the language, confidence to do the job.
Exactly.
As well as those people skills in both cultures, both groups, hearing and deaf. Yeah.
People skills. What a thought.
Yeah.
People skills.
What a thought. So with your experience of interpreting through the development of the profession, as well as teaching through the development of the profession, what is it that you liked about interpreting, and what is it that you liked about teaching interpreting?
Ooh, that's a good question. There's so much to like. I think it's fascinating work. I think if you enjoy languages at all, interpreting is just an amazing thing to try to take a thought in one language and make it somehow match in another language. You know, not just the words, but the dynamics, the emotions that are there to somehow convey those things. It's just such a challenging work to do. I mean, it's hard work, but it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I love getting to go to all different kinds of places. I did several years of private practice when I was in Texas, and enjoyed it so much. It just, going one day to watch a child be born. And of course, that wasn't the goal. The goal was for me to interpret, but to be there for such a sacred experience, you know, and to provide the access between the two people, the doctor and the mom, and to see that they got to communicate through that whole process like anybody else. It was just so fascinating to see all those things. But then also, I know some people don't think this is PC, but to have the joy of being the one to provide that access, you know, it's not about me when I'm in there.
Right.
But you just can't help but feel like you've actually provided a great service to connect people like that, who, if you weren't there, if there wasn't an interpreter there, they would end up having to write, and they may make a connection through writing, but it's not going to be as easy. It's not going to be as quick. It's not going to be as conducive to really understanding each other as far as the emotions and the dynamics and everything as it is when, you know, when you have someone to act as that intermediary. I just think that work is fascinating, not just in a childbirth thing, but working as an interpreter in that educational setting and see that light bulb go off. You know, somebody actually understood a new concept.
Yeah.
Because it went through your hands, you know, to them.
Yeah.
Being around other interpreters, being able to work with others in a teaming situation or just in social setting with interpreters who do the same thing, and, you know, being able to bounce ideas off of each other. There's just a real camaraderie there that maybe other fields have it, but I don't think they have it like we do, you know. It's just,
yeah.
And being around people like that is just so fun. Then you take it over to the teaching interpreting. You've got all of that fascination with the languages and working, and then to try to somehow convey that to people who are learning the language.
Mm-hmm.
That's so fun to see people pick that up, to start from the bottom, like I did, to start out with nothing. And then after a couple of years, they're ready to go out and interpret for somebody. That's just the coolest thing.
Yeah.
You know, to see them learn and to try to think of how to explain things. That's such a challenge. You know, somebody says, well, why do we do it that way? Well, you know, that's a real challenge, to come up with a way to try to explain why it works that way.
Mm-hmm.
And to introduce new people to this field is just a fun thing to do. I always enjoyed that a lot. Students are interesting. Deaf people are fascinating. The languages.
Yeah.
It's just fun.
It's good to be in a profession that you can enjoy, that you have passion for.
It really is. My mom used to always say, I'm so happy you found something that you like to do. Well, I am too. Thank you very much. She didn't understand it, but she was glad that I found something I like to do, because then it's not work. I mean, of course, it's still work. But
yeah.
And there are some days that it's not fun, but most of the time it is. If you look at the actual process and working through making decisions, it's just, it's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. Let's touch on that then.
Okay.
Making decisions as an interpreter, ethical decisions or dilemmas, that sort of thing. How has that, from your own experience, how has that changed from when you first started to now, or before you retired?
Yeah.
I always like that word retire. It's like, yes, I was tired and now I'm tired again.
Again.
I'm retired.
Retired.
Anyway, sorry.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't make sense.
Language is so interesting.
It is.
Why do we call it retired?
Yes.
Anyway.
So what was the question? Oh, yeah. So did you have the idea or the concept that, oh, this is an ethical situation, or this is a dilemma, I need to think what's good, what's bad? Did you have that focus or that philosophy or principle in the profession in the early days?
Back in the old days? We did back in the old days. I still have a copy of a book from ages ago, and I think it came out through vocational rehab or one of those governmental agencies, and it was a handbook for interpreters, and it had a copy of the RID Code of Ethics in it.
Okay.
And the Code of Ethics back then was pretty stringent as far as, you know, being sure that confidentiality was number one, I believe. And then all the other things about, you know, not taking a job that you're not ready for or that you're not qualified to do, pretty much had the basic ideas, the basic concepts that we have today in the Code of Conduct, you know, similar ideas. And that's been an interesting thing too over the years, watching the change in that very first Code of Ethics and then the revisions and revisions and revisions.
Yeah.
We're still basically trying to say the same thing, you know, but that has changed over the years. But yeah, it was there from the beginning, that need to have ethical standards to be able to do a professional job.
Yeah.
So you've got to have that.
Through the revisions over the years or through the experience, did it get clearer, easier to see what, you know, what to do, what not to do?
I don't know that those revisions helped that at all. I think they just kept trying to reword it, you know, but experience wise, it did get easier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you know, when Robin Dean came out with the demand control schema, I remember thinking it was great. It was so nice to have words and a way to explain what we do here, you know, when we're making decisions. And I think that for some interpreters who've been doing this for a long time, it was like, that's what we do. That's what we do. And she's explained it and made it clear as to to how we do that. Because I think sometimes we would look at things as, it's, you've got to be right on this line all the time. And There's no room for you to have any thought of your own. Mm-hmm. You just better make this decision because this says so. But with experience, you learn that there are times when we have to do something a little bit off of that line. Not, you know.
Yeah.
You don't want to go off to where it's unprofessional and unethical. But there are some times that you might have to do something that wouldn't have originally been thought to be by the book.
Yeah.
But I think with time and experience, that happens. That becomes a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Almost second nature to forget things so that you don't, what am I trying to say? We worked at forgetting things so that we could keep them confidential. Yeah. If I don't remember that I was there, I'm not going to end up telling anybody.
Yeah.
You know, things like that, that become second nature that you go, okay, I've got to be sure that I don't remember any of this, which I don't know if that's good for us once we're my age, but I've been practicing so many years at forgetting things that that's just natural.
I've been married long enough. I do that every day. Anyway. yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I'll make a note of that. Joni says it's a good skill for an interpreter to forget things, to have
that's
a
right.
bad memory. Wait a minute.
Bad memory. Now, not while you're interpreting, though. You want to remember everything.
flexible memory. There we go.
Flexible. That's right. Compartmentalize that.
Another fun episode with Joni. As we walk through the years with her, learning about how the pay has increased over time, how the testing has improved, how the codes of ethics have changed, how the experience has given us an evolution in how we think about the profession. But if we look closely, all of these events, all of these laws, all of these organizations have one goal in mind. And it's about the quality of the services that we bring to the communities. However, every move, every action that we take has consequences, some positive, some negative, some just different. The example of the law that introduced the idea that students have the right to go to school near their home. And that, of course, is good for increasing the number of interpreters, giving more jobs to interpreters in these mainstream, inclusive schools. But the downside to it is that the deaf schools slowly lose the population of students and eventually close down. It means that the community, the deaf community of these students, is dwindling. I don't have the answers, but sometimes we need to think, in your own country, is it worth it to have inclusion for the deaf community in education? What are the pros and cons? Is it what the community wants? These are questions we need to ask as we develop through the years. Again, we go back to quality. We go back to improving our skills, our people skills, as well as our interpretation skills. And for what Joni has shown us that has happened in these states in the U.S., we should be proud. They should be proud of what they have done. Look at your own country. What has changed over the years? You should be proud, and you should be proud of yourself as you develop in the profession, in the skills, getting experience and learning to improve yourself. What we do is amazing. I know hearing people say it all the time, and we think, well, it's just my job, or I'm just the interpreter. But no, it is a fascinating profession. How our brains can do what we do is amazing. So give yourself some confidence. Give your ego a little boost to know that you can do this. Throughout that development, striving for quality, we learned how to talk about our profession. And that is part of the definition of a profession, knowing how to describe what we do, how we do it, and why we do it. That defines us as a profession when we know the details of what we do. Being able to communicate that to each other and to others are part of the skills that we need to know. It gives us more clarity, more confidence, and more connection with each other and the communities that we serve. Let's not forget that, at least. For now, don't forget, next week, our conversation continues. Until then, keep calm, keep the destination to interpreting. I'll see you next week. Take care now.